So this is the 13th of September, 2013, in Honolulu, Hawaii. We're going to be looking at Bhagavad Gita as it is, chapter 13, text 8. Now, Prabhupada's put 8 through 12 together, but we're just going to look at text 8. In fact, we're only going to look at the first word of text 8, which is Amanitvan. And this Amanidvang is translated as humility. We're going to read all of, we'll read part of the translation here. There's a list of qualities that starts with humility. At the end of this list, Krishna says, all these I declare to be knowledge, and besides this, whatever they may be, is ignorance. And we're just going to read the section of the purport dealing with humility. Prabhupada says, as for the knowledge outlined here, the items may be analyzed as follows. Humility means that one should not be anxious to have the satisfaction of being honored by others. One should not be anxious to have the satisfaction of being honored by others. You might get the satisfaction of being honored by others, but one shouldn't be anxious for it. And what one shouldn't be anxious for is the satisfaction that comes when others are honoring one. That is how Prabhupada's defining humility. He goes on to say, the material conception of life makes us very eager to receive honor from others, but from the point of view of a man in perfect knowledge, who knows that he is not this body, anything, honor or dishonor, pertaining to this body is useless. One should not be hankering after this material deception. And throughout the Bhagavad Gita, you'll find Krishna talking about how one who's detached from this honor and dishonor is very dear to him. Now, we should note that this humility is the first in this list of the items of knowledge. By knowledge here, we look at the Sanskrit word, jnana. It doesn't mean the object of knowledge, which is a different word, jnana. It means the process of knowledge, how you get knowledge. And by knowledge here, also, Krishna's not talking about how to fix your carburetor, how to spell onomatopoeia, how to buy a plane ticket. He's not talking about that kind of knowledge, which is certainly important. Isha Upanishad says it's important. But that's not what he's referring to. He's referring to what we would commonly call wisdom, or realization, or enlightenment. So the process of gaining knowledge starts with humility. Well, that's logical. You're not going to learn anything if you think you already know. You know, that's pretty reasonable. Now, this humility, being the very beginning of acquiring real wisdom and real enlightenment, is, how should we say, it's part of the social milieu of the Hare Krishna movement. We have a lot of behaviors and language in our International Society for Krishna Consciousness that speaks to the fact that we value humility. When we talk to each other, we'll say things like, oh, I'm so fallen, I don't really know how to do that, you can go first. I've seen devotees in our Hare Krishna movement fight not over who will get something, but who will give it. So I've seen two people fighting over a mat to sit on, not I want it, no, you, but I want you to sit on it, no, I want you to sit on it, no, I want you to sit on it. So this sort of, yes, everyone has seen this?
Yes.
This kind of behavior and this sort of self-effacing language is very, very common in our Hare Krishna movement, because we put this strong value on humility. And of course, we put the strong value on humility not only because Krishna lists it as first in the items of gathering knowledge, but also because Krishna and his avatars, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, says this is the key to chanting the holy name. Yes? Everybody knows this verse. Trinada Pisum Chinachari Vasamishina Amanina Mamadena Kirtanina Sadhavi. That if you want to be absorbed, Sada, if you want to be always absorbed in the absolute truth, you want to be always absorbed in God, then you have to have this mood of humility, which Chaitanya Mahaprabhu defines very you might think outrageously. You have to be lower than the straw in the street. How do you get any lower than that? The bugs that are on the bottom of the straw in the street. You know, Prabhupada will talk about that the grass, when you step on it, it bounces back up. That's why people like to plant grass, because it bounces back up. So lower than the grass, you step on it, you don't bounce back up. I'm more tolerant than a tree. So a tree has tolerance in two ways. If it's thirsty, it doesn't ask for water. Like, you ask me, would you like anything? And I say, yes, I'd like some water. But the tree doesn't ask for water. It just stands there thirsty. So if it has an internal problem, it doesn't ask for help. And if it has an external problem, someone goes to cut a tree, it doesn't complain. So more tolerant than that. And we may hear such a description and go, ah! I don't want to have people step on me and I stay down. I don't want to have people cut me and I don't complain. I don't want to be thirsty and not ask for water. Is that the price? In fact, I'm just remembering many years ago, we were having some difficulty in the school I was running, and one of my good friends and godbrothers was talking to me, and he said, Ermila, you're like a cork. No matter how you get pushed down, you bounce back up. I said, yes. And kind of that sustained me for many, many years. Whenever there were difficult times, I thought, but I'm a cork. Right? And then one day I was thinking, well, wait a minute. If you want to be lower than the grass, maybe you're not supposed to pat back up. What does that mean? What is this humility anyway? So I see that although we in the Hare Krishna movement make a lot of show of humility, that when it comes down to it, we're not quite sure what in the world it is, and we're not quite sure if we really want it. Yes? Okay, everybody, if anyone steps on you, stay down. Anyone cuts you, don't say a word. If you're thirsty, you need something, don't ask for it. That's how you're going to become enlightened. We'd all leave, yes? Would anybody stay? Could you imagine that? Go out to the public. Become enlightened by letting everyone step on you. Would anybody come? Nobody would be interested. So we have this sort of tug of war going on, that we know this humility is really important, but we're not really sure if we want it. We're not really sure what it is. We're not really sure how to go about it. So many years ago, I decided that it was about time I started looking into this. Because the way I was dealing with this humility thing for a long time was just sort of, I kept pushing it to the back of the stove. I didn't even have it on the back burner. I just had it on the countertop. My pot wasn't cooking at all. You know, it wasn't even turned on. In my son's house on their stove, one of their burners doesn't work at all, but I didn't know that. And everybody was out one day and I was cooking and I put on the dal, you know, the beans and the water, and I had to turn it on. It's like, it's taking a long time to go. I realized it wasn't hot at all. So that's what I had done with humility. I just kind of put it on a non-working burner on the countertop. You know, I thought, I can't deal with this. So I was saying that I valued humility, but really in my heart, I wasn't dealing with it at all. And one day I thought, you know, I think I better deal with this. I think I better find out, what is this humility? So we have already, Krishna's told us it's the beginning of knowledge. We've had Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, who's also Krishna, telling us that it's the key to chanting all the time, to being absorbed in the absolute truth, which is what we want. Yes, everybody wants to be absorbed in the absolute truth, wants to be enlightened, that's what we want. Okay. Sanatana Goswami, a great teacher of Krishna consciousness, said that mature humbleness, this is the Brihad Bhagavatamrita, he says, mature humbleness brings love of God. It is seen that the two are in relationship of cause and effect. So we keep getting this idea that if you want wisdom, you want enlightenment, you want love of God, you've got to do this humble thing. I guess what really sparked my interest is in Bhaktivinoda Thakur's book, Bhajana Rahasya, which is a very esoteric and difficult book. It's not an easy read kind of book. But he takes the 8 verses of the Shikshastika and he correlates this with several things. He correlates it with the couplets in the Hare Krishna mantra, the 8 couplets of the 16 words of the Hare Krishna mantra. He correlates it with the 8 parts of the day of Krishna's pastimes, and he correlates it with the stages of enlightenment. So what Bhaktivinoda Thakur does is he says that if you want to become steady in bhakti, that correlates with this Trinadipi verse. That's the relationship. So we get this question all the time. Everywhere I go in the world, somebody will ask me, and I go lots of places in the world, somebody will ask me, how do I become steady? How do I become fixed in my practice? One day I'm enthusiastic about my meditation and my chanting, and the next day I'm not. You know, one day thinking about Krishna is easy, the next day it's not. One day I'm kind and compassionate, and the next day I'm not. Or the next minute I'm not. How do I remain steady? And Bhaktivinoda Thakur says, this is the doorway. If you want to go from unsteady practice of bhakti yoga to steady practice, you have to walk through the doorway of humility. Now, making it even more interesting is that Srila Prabhupada says that until you come to steadiness, bhakti yoga is a hard struggle with determination. And once you come to steadiness, everything else comes automatically and easily. So if we're finding that practicing bhakti yoga is a hard struggle with determination, that it's something we're having to do by willpower, and that we're not, again, steady in our success, and we'd like to come to the point that, you know, instead of walking up the mountain, you're gliding down the other side of it. I took a bike trip with a youth group through the Rocky Mountains when I was 16, and we did a lot of walking our bike up mountains. But the last 2 days we were coming out of Jasper Banff National Park, it was all downhill for 2 days.
Wow.
So if you want to come to the part of bhakti yoga, that's the wow. That's the all glow. You know, you're still pedaling the bike a little bit. Mostly not even pedaling. You're just staying on and not falling off anymore. We have to go through this doorway of humility. So when I read that in Bhajana Rahasya, I said, okay, let's stop fooling around with this thing. Let's look at it and find out what it is. Now, I knew that the social etiquette stuff wasn't the real thing. There were many years that I was very critical of the social etiquette thing. And thinking, you know, that, oh, I'm not really good at this, and I should be at this. Because I knew it was false. But all I had to do was, as part of getting my doctorate, I had to do an internship where I was an administrator in a public school, in an elementary school. And I noticed that among people who are not interested in spiritual life, they don't even pretend to be humble. And that was when I started valuing the pretense. I thought, well, at least we pretend. At least we have it as a value. Our pretense is saying, we value this. So I started valuing the pretense and saying it's creating a culture that this is important, even though it's superficial. Whereas among materialistic people, they don't even have a culture of it being important. They don't even have an idea that their pride and their arrogance is a problem, or that they even have it. But still, I knew that just having that etiquette thing wasn't the real thing. What is the real thing? What does it look like? And why is it so scary? You know? I said to one very good friend of mine, I said, it looks to me that that door is a door of fire. Like in the circus, they have the tigers jump through a hoop of fire. Again, you know, you look at this humility, I get stepped on and I don't get back up. Somebody cuts me, I don't complain. You know, it looks like a hoop of fire. And she laughed and laughed, and she said, I mean, well, it's not a door of fire, it's just a door. So what is it? So I concluded, and I don't mean at all for this to be comprehensive or the be-all and end-all of discussion of humility, but I concluded that humility must include three things. That first of all, it has to be honest and authentic. Second of all, it has to be grateful. And third of all, it has to be peaceful. And if you have authentic, grateful peace, then you're going to be filled with joy. I also concluded that the reason we're so scared of humility is we don't know what it is. What we're scared of is not humility. What we're scared of is the illusion of humility. That the illusory energy called Maya, that which is not, it says to us, this is humility. We look at it and go, ah, and we run in the other direction. And so we're running away from something that which is not. We're running away from something that's different from what it really is. All right, let's look at authenticity. So I have some nice quotes here. One is from Haridas Thakur. And he was getting old. He was ready to pass away from the world. And he said to Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, I would like to leave my body in your presence. And Lord Chaitanya said, please don't leave. Haridas Thakur replied, my Lord, if an insignificant insect like me dies, what is the loss? If an ant dies, where is the loss to the material world? So this is the truth. The truth is that we're all extremely insignificant. I mean, extremely so. So I asked this question many times in different parts of the world. So how many of you here know the names of your great-great-grandparents? Okay, one. So I've asked this to thousands of people, maybe 10, 15. This means our great-great-grandchildren will not know our name. That's the grandchildren of our grandchildren. So I have grandchildren. And if I think about the fact that their grandchildren will not know my name, what to speak of anything about me, what I'm doing, what kind of person I am, nothing. And that's our family. That's our own intimate family will not even remember our name. What to speak of the rest of the world? So how important are we? And you can make an experiment, take someone who really loves you and cares about you and says, will you please sit down for an hour and listen to me telling you everything I did today? You know, how important are we? We think we're so important. So humility is truthfulness. It's facing the fact that I'm very insignificant. Now, when we die, there'll be a sentence in the local newspaper. That's all. You know, for really, really big and important, my father was a big, important man. He got, I think, 4 or 5 paragraphs in the New York Times obituary. That's a whole life. Imagine your whole life in 4 or 5 paragraphs. And if you're really, really big in the Hare Krishna movement, you'll get one BTG article on you, 2,500 words. Generally, we don't put anything back to Godhead when somebody dies. You know, maybe they'll get a paragraph. If they're a really important person, we'll give them 2,500 words. Your whole life. All your hopes and your dreams and your ideas and all your stories boiled down to 2,500 words. What's that? Yeah. I had somebody come up to me in Vrindavan a few months ago and say, oh, I know you. You're Urmila. I said, yeah. They said, you're the famous cook. I said, no, that's not me. I said, you're thinking of Jamuna. So it's like that. Yeah, but we're so important. When we die, people have an excuse to have a feast, that's all. Yeah. A few people will miss us for a month or two. I mean, really, seriously. Now, how many people here in Honolulu know us? What to speak of on Oahu? What to speak of in Hawaii? What to speak of in America? How many people even know there's an island of Oahu? Seriously. You know, I travel in the world. People say, where do you live? I live in Hawaii. Oh, where? I say, on the Big Island. They say, well, that's Honolulu, right? No. I say, there's lots of islands. Oh, really? You know, it was really funny. My grandson started university on the Big Island. And one of my friends said, Hawaii has universities? I thought it was just coconut trees. Yeah, people, They don't even know where we live, what we're doing. So humility is this honesty. In terms of the universe, I'm like a little insect. What to speak of on the planet? So the Vedas tell us that all of the different heavenly bodies are inhabited. That there's various types of beings on the other planets and stars in the universe. So they certainly don't care about me in my life. I guarantee you. Nobody on Alpha Centauri really cares, you know, that I bruised my finger the other day. Or that, you know, so-and-so doesn't like me. Right? It doesn't matter. And by the way, when one realizes that one's very insignificant, the first feeling you'll feel is relief. You don't have to pretend to be somebody important, because we're not. It's such a relief. That's what Prabhupada is saying in this purport. You know, we put all this energy into being this important person. And we're not. I can't change the world. I can't change the universe. There's hardly anybody that really cares if I live or die or what I ate for breakfast. So, yeah. One time someone wrote a letter to Srila Prabhupada and said, I have a very big problem. And he signed it, your insignificant servant. And Prabhupada was laughing and laughing. And he said, just see, how can an insignificant person have a big problem? You know, as soon as you get this authenticity, I'm insignificant, we don't have any more big problems. We don't have to invest anything into maintaining our pride that we're important, that our opinions are important, that our doings are important. We don't have to defend our pride anymore. That's such a relief. We don't have to defend something that's false. Let other people think I'm not important. It's true anyway. So what does it matter? Now, it's also authentic. Humility is also authentic in the sense that whatever gifts and talents I have, whatever I do in my life, is not done by my own power. So this is from the purport to Bhagavatam 1:15:21. Prabhupada says, one should not be puffed up by borrowed plumes. All energies and powers are derived from the Supreme Source, Lord Krishna. And they act as long as he desires and cease to function as soon as he withdraws. Prabhupada, in a letter to Sukadeva, wrote one of my favorite quotes anywhere from Srila Prabhupada. He says, Krishna has given everyone something extraordinary, and to serve Krishna with one's extraordinary talent means successful life. So I may be a speck in the universe, but I've been given some extraordinary talent by Krishna. Prabhupada says, everyone has something extraordinary, but it's not mine. It's not mine. It's Krishna's. Therefore, there's no pride. And the manifestation of humility is very simple. I use it for Krishna. Sometimes people say, well, I don't want to use my talents in Krishna's service because then I'll become proud. You know, I don't want to do what I'm good at for Krishna because then I'll become proud. If you're really humble, you'll say, Krishna gave this to me, I better use it for him. No? If somebody gives you or lends you something, don't they want to see that you use it nicely? Isn't that like the whole point? Many years ago, I gave somebody a donation, and they recently told me, oh, I lost all that money in 2 days. You think I was happy? So I'm not quite sure why they told me that. That's not what I wanted to hear. I wanted to hear, oh, I gave you a donation. Oh, I used that money for this wonderful thing and this wonderful thing. Yes, don't you all feel like that? If you give someone a gift, don't you want to see them use it? And don't you want to see them enjoy using it? Prabhupada also says that when we enjoy our service, Krishna becomes very happy. Doesn't that make sense? When I was recently in Johannesburg, so the woman at whose house I was staying gave me a sari, and I said, well, that's not really going to be suitable for my traveling. It's too heavy. And she said, oh, can you wear it once while you're here? Right? And when I wore it, she wanted me to say, I like it. Thank you. It's beautiful. So that's what Krishna wants us to do with the talents that he's given us. Being authentic and being humble means my talents, my abilities, my intelligence are lent to me by God, and they should be used for his glorification and the good of the world, the good of the universe. They shouldn't be hidden, and they shouldn't be used selfishly. Pride is either I hide my talents or I use them for myself. Humility is I use them for the glorification of God. I use them for the benefit of others. And I always remember they're not mine. How do we know our talents are not ours? What's our main evidence that our talents are not ours?
They can be taken away.
How fast can they be taken away? Instantly. Yes?
Yeah.
Car accident, fall down the stairs, disease.
Paralysis.
So many things. And we can lose everything. We can lose all of our knowledge. Whatever we're, you know, we tend to think this is mine. My social connections, my knowledge. Yes?
Krishna tells us I am the ability of man.
Yes.
It's
not only lent by Krishna, it is Krishna. So that also brings us great joy and freedom. I don't have to define myself by my talents and abilities. They're not me. One devotee, Braja Vihari, told me that when one woman was passing away in Vrindavan, she said the hardest thing to let go of was this concept that she was an artist. Her whole life she had defined herself by, I am an artist. And in her last days she couldn't do art anymore. And she had to give that up. So if we're defining ourselves, I am good at this, I am good at this, I know that, then we're full of fear and anxiety. But what's authentic is, these things are the gifts of Krishna, they are Krishna, they're mine to use for his glorification and the elevation of me in others. And when they come, they come, and when they go, they go. They were never mine to begin with. If someone lends you something and then comes to get it, what is the lamentation? There's a very famous true story in the Jewish tradition of this one rabbi who had two sons, very great scholars, very respected in the community. And one day when he was teaching, both of his sons contracted an illness and died. When he came home, they were both dead. And he came to the door and his wife said, my dear husband, some time ago a merchant was traveling through here and asked that we could keep two jewels for him while he went on his travels, and today he came to ask for them back. What should I have done? And the husband said, well, of course, if they're his, you should give them back. And she says, today our sons have died. So that is the mood of the humble devotee. And as it says in the Bible, the Lord gives, the Lord takes away, blessed be the name of the Lord. As long as we're trying to hold on to our talents and abilities, thinking they're us, that they define us, and they're meant to be used for our own pleasure, we're going to be full of anxiety. And as soon as we're truthful and authentic, and say, whatever talents and abilities I have, and Prabhupada says, everyone has something extraordinary. These are lent to me for a purpose, and when that purpose is over, they will be withdrawn. Let me relish using them properly. And that reciprocation with Krishna. Let me not relish the talents themselves. So we can feel a kind of divine pride that I'm acting as a servant of Krishna. I'm using Krishna's gifts for him. Now this kind of authenticity means that if you have $1 million in the bank, you don't say, oh, I'm so poor. That's the false humility. You know, you got an IQ of 370 and you say you're stupid. Or you're, you know, on the cover of Vogue magazine and you say you're ugly in the name of humility. That's a lie. Humility, how can humility be a lie? If humility is one of the ornaments of enlightened beings, and if it's the key to enlightenment and it's the key to truth, how can it itself be a lie? So that was kind of my first logical understanding. If we're trying to come to the absolute truth, param satyam dhimahi, meditating on the absolute truth, and if humility is the door to the absolute truth, humility itself must be truthful. It can't be beautiful women saying they're ugly and rich men saying that they're poor and so forth. It's got to be truthful. So it's got to be, there's a lot of money in my bank account, but it's not mine, it's Krishna's. He's given it to me, he'll take it away while I have it, I'm meant to use it. I'm such an insignificant speck that my grandchildren's grandchildren will not know my name, but I'm a part of Krishna and I've been given something extraordinary to do for you. And that's authentic. And it relieves us of all this false stuff that we're trying to maintain. So that's the first thing. Humility is authentic. It's truthful. I am a spiritual being, part and parcel of God. I have a wonderful spiritual qualities. I have some work and some business to do in this world on behalf of the Lord, but I have nothing to do with this world. And I'm not some big important person in this world. The next thing that I saw is that a person who's humble will feel very grateful. Now, I had an epiphany about this on my 45th birthday. One devotee in the temple where I lived organized a huge party for my birthday. I mean, it was huge. The whole community, I don't remember anybody not being there, showed up. And I hadn't expected anything. You know, usually with surprise parties, you have some idea that maybe your family's making a cake or something, but I didn't have a clue. And I came to the temple and everybody was there and it was this huge party. And the whole time I felt full of gratitude. And what I realized was I felt gratitude because I hadn't expected it and I didn't think I deserved it. So a very simple question. You got $20 in your wallet, you go to the store, you buy something that's worth $20. How do you feel? Okay, right? $20 in your wallet, go to the store, you buy something, when you get home, you find out it was only worth $5. How do you feel? $20, go to the store, you buy something, and you find out it was worth $100. How do you feel? Our amount of happiness with what we get is in inverse proportion to how much we think we deserve it. The amount of happiness we get is in inverse proportion to how much we think we deserve it. The amount of happiness we get is in inverse proportion to how much we think we deserve it. Think about relationships. If you think this person is my husband, therefore he should, you won't enjoy any of those things he does that you think he should. Isn't that interesting? As soon as you think, I deserve this, this person should, you can't get practically any happiness from it at all. Isn't that interesting? It's only when you think what my husband's doing for me, what my wife's doing for me is a gift given voluntarily, which is the truth, by the way. As soon as you think I deserve nothing, that doesn't mean everyone's going to abuse you. That's the Maya. Oh, if you think you deserve nothing, then everybody will abuse you. No, if you think you deserve nothing, then everything you get, you're going to feel so grateful for. I mean, I only had $20 in my wallet. I've got thousands of dollars worth of stuff in my life. But if you think I got $1,000 in my wallet, you're not going to appreciate the $1,000 worth of stuff. You think, well, I earned it. Isn't that funny? The person who thinks, I don't deserve anything. I have no claims on life. The famous Christian writer, C.S. Lewis, he said, no one is upset by misfortune, but rather by misfortune conceived of as injury. And we only think it is injury when we have a claim on life. And the more claims, the more we are put out of sorts. I do this, and I do this, and I do this. I have a right to this. This is, our modern society is very filled with this rights consciousness. Vedic society is very filled with duty consciousness. By the way, if everyone does their duty, everyone gets their rights. Yes? If everyone does their duty, everyone gets their rights. But there's a big difference between a duty-oriented culture and a rights-oriented culture. And unfortunately, we're moving more and more to a rights-oriented culture, which means you're always going to be dissatisfied. I have a right to this, and a right to this, and a right to this, and I'm owed this, and I deserve this, and I deserve this, and I deserve this, all in the name of self-esteem. And then you're never going to be happy with anything, because you're never going to think you get as much as you deserve. And when you get as much as you deserve, it's like, well, of course I got that. That's what I deserve. And it can't give you any happiness. Funny, isn't it? If I had thought that the whole temple was obligated to give me a birthday party, I wouldn't have enjoyed it. And if I thought they were obligated to give me a birthday party at the Ritz-Carlton Hotel, then I would have just been angry. Does this make sense to anyone? So humility is grateful. Humility, who am I? What can I demand? What do I have the right to demand? Of course, this is saying that we don't have the right to demand anything implies that we're seeing ourselves honestly. Therefore, we started with honesty. I'm a spiritual being, a perfect spiritual being full of divine qualities that is willingly put myself into illusion. We don't even demand of Krishna. We don't go to Krishna and say, I demand enlightenment. We don't even go to Krishna and say, I demand service. We say, please engage me in your service. We make a request, not a demand. And we're not chanting with, okay, Krishna, 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 Hare Hare, you give me what I want now. Come on, come on. Where's the ecstasy? And you see this mentality of rights consciousness destroys relationships. Completely destroys relationships between husband and wife, parents and children, friend and friend. And if you want to examine what damages our relationships in a spiritual society, a lot of it is this rights consciousness. Now, I deserve to be treated a certain way. And you can make a little experiment, you know, and I've done this in my own life. I know my seat's a few inches higher, but that's really for the chair, for the book, rather. The chair is for the book, the chair's not for me. I'm not saying I don't do this, okay, I'm just saying. But I find when I get offended at people's treatment of me, if I look under it, it's always because I had some sort of deserve thing in there. Well, I deserve. Now, this doesn't mean you're supposed to stand around while people beat you up. This body belongs to Krishna, the mind belongs to Krishna. We're supposed to defend our body, we're supposed to defend our mind, but we're not supposed to defend our pride and our ego. We are in a spiritual movement, I assume, yes, to get rid of the false ego, yes? At least the day we walked in the door, that was our aspiration. Let me dissolve this false ego. So when somebody helps us to dissolve it, why don't we thank them? Why do we defend it? You can try sometime. You can try. Say, for the next day, I'm not going to defend my false ego. Even if someone accuses me of something I didn't do, I'm just going to accept it. I'm not going to say anything at all. I'll just be silent. I'll just agree with it. Like Srivas Thakur, when they put all the paraphernalia for Durga worship outside his door, he came out and said, yes, I'm a Durga worship. You can try a little experiment. And then whatever we get, we're grateful. Yeah, it doesn't mean that we have to stand there while people insult us and while people throw rocks at us. And it's not that Krishna wants us to be abused. We're not saying that. But we don't have to defend the false ego. And then we can feel grateful for anything. Whatever the blessings, all of us have blessings in our life, yes? Does anyone here have just barely enough clothes, or do you have some extra? I remember when I was running a school, we had a children's story about this community in Africa, and this one little boy had one set of clothes, and he said, why do I need more than one? I only have one body. So do we have extra clothes? What about food? Do we have extra food? Do we have only the food we need to live to survive? And what about variety of food? We have more than one kind of fruit? More than one kind of vegetable, more than one kind of grain. And we have kinds of kinds. We have kinds of apples and kinds of oranges and kinds of wheat and kinds of rice. Yes? So we have so much to be grateful for. Just being given the opportunity to take birth in the material world and try to fulfill our material desires. Krishna could take the rebellious souls and put us in a state of perpetual suspended animation. Or like some religions say, send you to hell eternally. He doesn't do that. He gives us the facility to try to enjoy it in so many ways. So there's so much to be grateful for. But only if you think, I deserve nothing. Whatever I get is good is a gift. Anything I get is a gift. And the gifts of the Lord are given from His love, not because we deserve them. Many of you have children. You give your children things just because you love them. Isn't it like that? Or your parents, hopefully, unless you had really awful parents. Didn't they give you things just out of love? You didn't have to earn everything they gave you, I hope. Maybe some of you had really difficult parents. I mean, my parents gave me things just because they were my parents, not for any particular reason. I didn't have to, you know, have a punch card and a timesheet and fill out everything just to get everything. So Krishna's giving us things not because we're earning them, but just because He loves us. All right, so humility is authentic, and it is also grateful. And then finally, it is peaceful. Grateful for the blessings in life, which we all have many of. Even if we have a very, very difficult life, we still have many blessings in our life. And then peaceful with the things that are difficult. Peaceful with the things that seem like great burdens and catastrophes and horrible things. You know, this is explained by Lord Brahma in 10.14.8, where he says, "My dear Lord, one who earnestly waits for you to bestow your causeless mercy upon him, all the while patiently suffering the results of his past misdeeds and offering your respectful obeisances with his heart, words, and body, is surely eligible for liberation, for it has become his rightful claim." So this is, you could say, the flip side of the deserved thing. Because most of us believe that I don't deserve to suffer. And I just, sorry, there's an echo here. Most of us think that if something bad happens to us, it couldn't possibly be something that's fair. Generally, we see that the bad things are in our life as we're being victimized in some way. And I also found it interesting that we espouse this philosophy of the law of karma. And when we look at other people suffering, it's not that hard for us to say, well, they must have done something to deserve that. Do you find that? That you can do that? But somehow when something happens to ourselves, it's so much harder to say, you know, I've really done something to deserve this. Most of us have a very inflated idea of what kind of person and character we have. Most of us think that we're much better motivated than we really are. Right? That we're in a much higher level than we actually are. And a good way to understand this is think of people that you live with or work with that you know well, you like them. Can you see the flaws in their character that they can't see? Do you all have this experience? The people that you love, not people you critical of. People you care about. People you like to be with. But I'm sure you can see their character flaws. And if you try to tell them, they might get angry, yes? Even if they ask you. I had a friend once who asked me, what's my biggest problem? I said, oh, no, you don't have any problem. She kept pushing, and finally I said, well... And I got angry emails and phone calls for the next month. So I figure it's got to work the other way, too. Figure that the people who know me well and work with me can see a lot of flaws in me that I can't see in myself. Yes. Maybe I'm not as nice of a person as I think I am. Now, one thing that happens as you advance in spiritual life and as you go on chanting Hare Krishna is that you'll start to see. This is a warning for those of us, if any of you are starting on the path of bhakti. You'll see the truth. You're coming to bhakti, you're saying, I want truth. You're going to get it. It may be private. The look in the mirror may happen in the privacy of your room with nobody around, but I guarantee you, you're going to get some looks in the mirror and you're not always going to like what you see. We are getting, the suffering we're getting is coming because we don't have as good of motives as we should, and we don't do as things that are as good as we should. And generally, we do not see the depth of the, I'm sorry to say, evil that we do. And I had I've had many interesting experiences in this regard, but one in particular that I'm thinking of right now, I was working with a person for years who kept telling me, you know, you're not respecting my boundaries, you're not respecting my boundaries, you're not respecting my space. And I couldn't understand what he was saying. What's he talking about? Of course I respect his boundaries. He couldn't get it. And then years later, I dealt with someone who didn't respect my boundaries. And after a few months of that, I went, oh my God, that's me. The famous psychic Edgar Cayce said, karma is meeting yourself. And all of a sudden, it was just, I could understand it. Oh, that's what I did all those years. I was doing what this person's doing to me that's driving me crazy. I was doing it to this other person. I was justifying it just like this other person's justifying it to me. And I caused this person a lot of pain. Now, most people in this world are terrified of seeing that about themselves. And they think that if they admit to themselves and others that I have some really evil parts to my nature, that they won't be lovable anymore, that everybody will walk away from them. But it's exactly the opposite. When we start seeing ourselves honestly, only then can we deal with it. And then we can also be peaceful with the difficulty that comes our way. We can say, oh, this difficulty is here to purify me. It's here to help me. It's here to bring me to the place that I actually want to go. So these are the three things that I've seen about humility. First of all, it's truthful. Truthful about our insignificance and truthful about our talents and gifts and abilities. That it's grateful. It's grateful for every blessing. Humility notices every minute blessing and is full of gratitude for every minute blessing. And true humility is a total peace with the difficulties, knowing that I brought these difficulties ultimately on myself, and they are for my good, and they are just and fair. And when a person has that, that person becomes full of joy. The fears are gone. There's nothing to be afraid of. I'm not afraid of suffering because I know the suffering is for my good, to balance me, to rectify me, to clean me. I'm not afraid of being honest because the honest truth is liberating.
Sorry,
so.
I can't handle the innocence.
Oh, I'm sorry. So that's what I've come to understand about humility. And then in going towards humility, it's good to make some kind of a plan. Some practical plan. Like, for example, we can make a practical plan that for the next 3 days, I'm not going to defend my ego. That's a real practical plan. One can make a plan for the next 3 days, I'm going to meditate on what all the blessings I have in my life. Somebody once said to me, suppose you woke up tomorrow only with the things that you felt gratitude for today. Whoops. That I'll be willing for the next 3 days that when Krishna in my heart or somebody points out my flaws, that I'll be willing to look at it. That I won't want to run away from that. And then Krishna is so pleased with our going towards humility that he will help. He will certainly help. to make some steps. And because humility is so joyful and is so peaceful, that when one goes through that door, then one will just be riding your bike down those mountains. No more pushing them uphill. And then everything in spiritual life, all wisdom, all enlightenment, and all love of God will come very, very easily. And if one stays on the other door of this humility and is eager for the satisfaction of being honored by others, then one will be struggling and struggling and struggling and struggling in spiritual life, maybe for many, many, many lifetimes. So questions, comments, corrections, additions, subtractions, chastisements. Yes?
It's, you talked in the beginning about the paradigm we see in our society of artificial humility.
Yes.
And then you talked about very scary, the door of fire. You've kind of removed that by your talk. You sort of took the scariness away from that door.
That was my intention.
You did a good job.
Thank you.
So now, how do we realistically go through that door? You gave a couple of examples, but they seem a little mechanical, okay, for the next
couple of days. Oh, very good. I like that. They seem mechanical. So, I don't have a board handy, but now I'm going to go to my teaching. I'm going to go to teacher mode. Is that all right? I'm going to give you an example from education. So, whenever you learn anything, there's four stages. This is education theory. This isn't Shastra. First stage is called unconscious incompetence. Next stage is called conscious incompetence. Next stage is called conscious competence. And last stage, unconscious competence. Look at that. Unconscious incompetence. You're doing it wrong, you don't know you're doing it wrong. Conscious incompetence. You know you're doing it wrong, but you become aware of it. Conscious competence. You're doing it right mechanically. Unconscious competence, you're doing it right naturally. Everybody wants to skip those two conscious steps. They want to jump from unconscious incompetence to unconscious competence. People want to just jump from being an illusion to being enlightenment. Boof! Okay, those in-between steps are called sadhana bhakti, practice. Or Krishna also calls it abhyas yoga, which means repetition. And there's some assumption or implication that if you're practicing something, it's going to feel somewhat artificial in the practice stage. It's not artificial, but if you're practicing it, it will feel somewhat artificial. Prabhupada gives example, Rupa Goswami gives example of a child learning to walk. So if you've ever seen a child learning to walk, so the beginning stages require tremendous focus and concentration on the part of the child. They have to, you know, stand up. Usually they first stand up holding on to something, and then they let go, right? And they fall a lot, and then they take one step, and they have to put all their attention into this thing. They can't be distracted for a moment. Now, when we walk, we don't have to do that. We just walk. So if you say to the child, well, you should just get up and walk, you know, like a giraffe does. Giraffes born, and they get up and run. So you say to a human child, you know, just go run. Why should you go through this painstaking process? But that's what it is. Or learning how to read. So, you know, I put together this book series on learning how to read. And it's really interesting in the education community that when you're a good reader, you read phrases. You read several words at a time. And you're predicting what word's going to come next. You don't sound out words anymore when you're a good reader, generally speaking. So there were some educators who said, well, good readers don't sound out words, and they read whole phrases, so let's teach kids to do that from the beginning. It was an utter failure. When you're teaching a kid how to read, you have to do, you know, they have to sound out, tap. Prabhupada talks about the Uttama coming down to the Majjhima platform to preach. It's kind of like that. If you're a good reader, but you're teaching kids how to read, you can't teach them to read the way you read. You have to teach them to read by sounding out the individual letters in the groups of letters. So when we're reawakening our natural state of enlightenment, we are going to go through this awkward practice stage. But because we're practicing something that's natural, like a child's practicing walking, but that walking is natural, by practice, it will come to the point that it's automatic. If you're practicing something that's unnatural, it will never become automatic. But if you practice something that's natural, it will become completely automatic. You'll get to the point of unconscious competence. Or as we say in our own terminology, spontaneous. It will get to the point that it's spontaneous. It will get to the point that humility, which is a natural attribute of the soul, is just what we are. We don't think about it at all. You're not even going to notice that you're being humble. You know, that's the other kind of funny thing, like, I was just being humble, you know, that kind of thing. But at a certain point, you won't even notice you're being humble. It's just who you are. You won't have to be humble about your humility, kind of thing. But yeah, take some deliberate practice. Just like we say, you know, chant minimum 16 rounds. So if you're really at the point, there's this quote up in the room that I'm saying that I don't know how much nectar is in the two syllables Krishna. If you're at that point, you don't have to take a vow of chanting 16 rounds. Probably said 16 rounds wouldn't be enough. You'd want to chant 16,000 rounds. If you love somebody, nobody can keep you from talking about them and thinking about them. But we're making a deliberate effort. Oh, okay, I've got to chant my rounds. Uh-oh, you know, it's 8 o'clock at night, I have a round left to chant. That's a deliberate effort, isn't it? That doesn't mean it's a mechanical process. Does that make some sense to you? What's really happening is when you make an effort, Krishna is pleased. And when he's pleased, he helps you. It's really a personal reciprocation going on. That's really what's happening. It's not that you're doing something mechanical like learning ballet dancing and then you get good at it. That's not really what's happening. Something like, again, as a teacher, if I say to the kids, okay, everybody do the first 20 problems on page 50, and then you have some kids who immediately walk up to your desk and say, I don't know how to do it. And you always say to them, what do you say to them?
Try.
Did you read the instructions? No. Did you try to work a problem? No. Well, I'll tell you what, why don't you sit down here, read the instructions, try to work one problem, and then I'll help you. So it's like that. If you just go to Krishna and say, you know, give me humility, Lord, come on. He's like, have you read the instructions? Have you tried to work the first problem? Yes, I hear you coming through my ear. Okay. Yes, regarding authenticity. How do you get to know what you need to know and don't know it? That's called Jnana Dipena Bhasrata. Krishna will reveal. All you have to do is want to know. All you have to do is want to know. You have to go to Krishna and say, I want to know the truth, and then you have to mean it. And how will he know that you mean it? He'll show you a little bit and see how you respond. Very simple. Go to Krishna, I want to know the truth, I want to see the truth. I want to see the truth about myself, I want to see the truth about the world, my relationships, I want to see ultimately the absolute truth. And he'll say, okay, here's a little bit of truth. That thing you just did the other day was based on envy. Here, let me show it to you. How do you respond? Do you say, oh no, was it? I'm not envious. I don't want to be envious. Or you say, oh, I'm so envious. Or you go, oh, wow, that's awful. What can I do about it? Show me what it really is. Give me the desire to let it go. And then he'll get all excited. And he'll say, wow, you really do want to see the truth. Okay, here's some more. And, you know, truth is, you'll see two things, Krishna and Maya. You'll see beautiful Krishna, and you'll see how ugly Maya is. You have to see both. And you see both. And how do you respond? Just like Krishna says to Arjuna, he said, now I have explained everything to you. Is your illusion now gone? Are you prepared to act according to my instructions? Deliberate on this fully and decide what you wish to do. It's not going to interfere with our free will. But that's how you see truth. It's very simple. It's not a difficult thing. Krishna wants you to see. He is truth. He wants you to see truth. He wants you to be with him. He wants us to be in the truth. He doesn't want us to be in falsity. The only reason we're in falsity is that we want to be in falsity. Yes? Sure.
You mentioned one of the most difficult components of authentic humility is turning the mirror on ourselves or when others hold up that mirror in front of us.
Yes.
So I've seen both in my life and in others using the excuse not to see our own egotistic mentality taking over and using the excuse of, oh, you're just being a fault finder, or just reverting to another excuse, I'm doing the best I can. So how do we really go beyond that and genuinely serve in a lot of humility?
You can give yourself a little mantra. I'm here to dissolve the false ego, not to defend it. It's what I came for. It's what I walked in the door for. I walked in the door to realize my spiritual nature and dissolve the false ego. And if somebody's helping me do that, that's great. Now, that's what Bhaktisiddhanta said. He said, someone who criticizes me is my friend. Someone who flatters me is my enemy. And even if what they have to say about me is false, I don't have to defend it. Occasionally you may have to defend it. If admitting to something that's not true would cause harm to others. But generally not. Not wanting to have the satisfaction of being, not being anxious of having the satisfaction of being honored by others. Not being anxious to have the satisfaction of being honored by others. So if everybody thinks that I'm a lowlife, so what? Who cares? My grandchildren's grandchildren won't even know my name. Who cares if somebody right now thinks that I'm a lowlife? What does it matter? I'm insignificant. Do I really care if after I'm this body there's a paragraph in the newspaper praising me or not? Krishna loves me. He thinks I'm important. And what you see is that if you don't defend your ego, people will generally like you more anyway. Isn't it? And your relationships will be better anyway. Do you know how many arguments people have just defending their pride and ego? It's amazing. Just listen to somebody else, two other people having an argument sometimes. You'll see mostly what they're arguing about is they're each defending their pride and their ego. It just doesn't matter. You can just say, you know, yeah, I'm a fool. So I've said this before, how Prabhupada says that if you read through the Bhagavatam systematically, that at the end of the ninth canto, you'll be a self-realized soul. So Burajan and Rani in Vrindavan have taught, they're probably practically the only people in the whole movement who've taught the entire Bhagavatam systematically from Canto 1 through Canto 12. Every verse. So I was having dinner with Burajan Prabhu, and I said to him, so? Prabhupada said, if you read the first nine cantos, every word, you'll become a self-realized soul. Did it happen to you? Did you become self-realized? He said, oh, yes. He said, I realized I'm an idiot. So that's, again, it's liberating. You know, I don't have to defend something that's not me. It's false ego. I don't have to pretend to somebody that I'm something that I'm not. You can just tell that to yourself. I don't have to do this. And at first it may feel awkward. At first, you know, there may be the thing welling up, I've got to defend myself. And then, no, I'm not going to try. Tell Krishna today I wasn't going to defend myself. And you say, okay. You're right.
So you're saying because the premise is the call of giving up false ego, then that should be the precursor to it.
Yeah. That's what we want to do, yes. That's the definition of liberation, is the dissolution of the subtle body. Yes, isn't that our philosophy? Correct? That is our philosophy, yes. If that is the definition of liberation, is the dissolution of the subtle body. Sarvapati Vinirvaktam Tattvar Kami Nirmala Shikesha Vichikana Sedna Bhakti Vichita. That's what we give lip service to, yes? And correct, yes? That's right. So it's an opportunity to do it. Somebody's going, you give me to you, you don't have to say anything, just smile. Or, I'm sorry. Now, sometimes you can't do that. Sometimes. So Narada Muni had a disciple who was a snake, and he told the snake to stop biting people. And then he came back later and said, how is it going? And he said, well, all the children are throwing rocks at me. He said, well, don't bite, but you can show your hood. So there may be sometimes, and I always tell the story how we had a school in North Carolina that, as a school, was exempt from property taxes, and we got a new tax assessor who wanted to, he had as his goal to make all the tax-exempt places in the county pay taxes. That was his mission. So he said, we have to pay property tax because we have people living on the property. And we said, well, there's nothing in the law that says we can't have people living in the property. You know, and he said, well, you're the only school in this county that has people living. Well, we show there are schools in other counties. I mean, we did all this. And anyway, he was still fighting us and fighting us and fighting us. So one of his agents came to the school one day and asked our principal, do you live here? Oh, yes. And what is your job? So he was trying to be very humble, and he said, I'm the custodian. He was the principal. But he did take care of the property. So he said, I'm the custodian. So we went to the hearing, and they were saying, they have to pay property tax because they're living on the property. And we said, well, there's all these other schools where the principal and the teachers are living on the property. And they said, well, it's not principals you have living on the property, it's a custodian. We went there and he said he was the custodian. And they asked our principal, did you say you were the custodian? He said, yes. And we lost the case. We won on appeal. We had to pay one round of property taxes. So sometimes it may be appropriate to defend. Or another example that I gave was when my mother first visited the temple. And she went to the temple president and said, so what are your qualifications for being temple president? Now, out in the world, if someone asks you that, you answer. Oh, well, I have a bachelor's in business administration, and I worked for 2 years managing a Home Depot, right? So the temple president said to my mother, I don't have any qualifications. I'm just doing this because my spiritual master asked me to do that. So for the next 10 years, whenever she'd see me, she said, and your leaders aren't qualified. So, you know, there may be some times when it's appropriate to defend, but generally not. So sometimes you want to show your hood, but generally if people accuse us of this or that, we have that one. Let them accuse. Yes?
So in this analogy of the snake, and defending the position, Narada Muni describes in the Mahabharata that if a younger person can respect an elder, he can be happy and make spiritual advancement. So what is the duty of someone who's an elder and someone is disrespecting him? How would that person act? How would he show his fangs without biting?
Well, it depends on whether or not that junior is your service to train or not. So if that junior is your child or your disciple and you have the duty to train them, then you have to say, just like sometimes disciples would come into Prabhupada's room and they wouldn't offer obeisances. And he said, no, you have to offer obeisances. But if it's not your duty to train them, it's not that you deserve respect. Not to be anxious of having the satisfaction of being honored by others. That's how Prabhupada's defining. Not being anxious of having the satisfaction of being honored by others. So if someone's my student or my child, that's another thing. Then it's my duty to train them. Not because I want the satisfaction of being honored by them. But otherwise they won't be able to function in society. Does that make sense? Yes, I can take another question through my ear. I haven't said anything yet. Yes? Hare Krishna? This is so weird. Should you read the Bhagavad Gita in your mind or out loud? Is that your question? You can do it both ways, either way. Doesn't matter. You can read it in your mind and you can read it out loud. All right? If you read it out loud, then even the bugs in your room will benefit, but you're also welcome to read it silently. Okay, any... Huh? Both ways are correct, yes. Certainly. We could take one more and then we should end. Anything else? No?
I have kind of comment.
Okay, yes.
It looks very interesting that gap that I had Prabhu ask very nice question in the beginning, and then how to get from that first stage to another stage. How like we want, looks like we more like used to automatic, to be in automatic mode.
Mm.
And Socrates said very good, I think Socrates said that, he said that we should take the best things from life and make it habit.
Mm.
Because mind is have such ability to be attached.
Take the best things in life and make them a habit.
Yeah,
yes,
so that's that part when we mechanically can say that we practice.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you, all you have to do is, okay, what's my goal? And then what can I do now to advance toward that goal? And as you do that, Krishna will help you to see what is the next step and what is the next step and what is the next step. And it's also interesting, one of my favorite sections of the Shastra is the book Bhakti Loka by Bhakti Vinoda, his Niyamagraha section, where he talks about that as you progress, the rules change. So what's appropriate on the lower stage is not appropriate on the higher stage, and what's appropriate for the higher stage is not appropriate for the lower stage. So this is also true with going to deeper and deeper levels of humility. And what you may take as an effort and a vow at one state, you may get to a point where you actually don't want to do that anymore, and you're going on to something more. So thank you very much. I hope this has provided at least that we can have a vision of what's on the other side of the door that we want. My two goals are that we see that what's on the other side of that door is what we want, and we see it's just a door. That it's not scary. And that going through that door will be a joyful experience. Because once we see that, then everything else will come. Then the details of how to do it will come naturally. The main problem is when you see that it's something really scary and something that's going to make you really vulnerable, something that's going to, you know, have you be abused and dejected and depressed and all that kind of thing, and you think, well, I don't know if what's on the other side is worth that kind of price. And so if you see that, first of all, what's on the other side is worth practically any price, and second of all, that it's really a joyful and a liberating process, not a mission. So tomorrow, Krishna willing, we will discuss forgiveness, which I see is another topic like this one, that it's something where we think forgiveness is something that it isn't, and therefore we shy away from it, that we don't see the benefits of it, and we don't see how to do it. And we're going to go through a real step-by-step, not only look at what forgiveness is, but a real step-by-step process by which we can enter into forgiveness. So thank you very much. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.
And that was a half hour earlier because of rain.
Yes, tomorrow will be 5 o'clock, and we have to end tomorrow at 6, so...